This episode is brought to you by CBS All Access. If you don't already subscribe to CBS All Access, please use our affiliate link by going to talkthroughmedia.com/CBS. Using our affiliate link gives us a little credit, which helps us to keep bringing you great content. U.S. residents only. Hello, and welcome to episode 16 of the Star Trek Picard cast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Ruthie.
And we have a very special episode for you. We have been talking quite a while now, several weeks, about how much we enjoyed The Last Best Hope. Well, I guess the actual title is Star Trek Picard, The Last Best Hope. Is that right? Anyway.
Yeah, that'd be right.
Yeah. Well, we are pleased to have Una McCormack, who is the author of Star Trek Picard, The Last Best Hope. Una, that's great to have you on here.
Very glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
And when I say how much we enjoyed the novel, I do not regularly read a novel three times, but I've read yours three times. So,
it's not been out that long. That's well done. It's been out about a month, hasn't it?
Yeah. 2 months. Well, yeah, probably 2 months now. But one thing that we've said on this podcast is that that novel could have easily, in our opinion, been like the first season or two, maybe, of Star Trek Picard. And, just want to just congratulate you for such a well-written, well-drawn novel. Like, just,
well, keep it coming. I love hearing this kind of thing.
So
if you hadn't liked it, I'd have just exited the meeting.
Yeah, so. I know.
The power of Zoom. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, bad connection. Click.
So the first question I've got is, this is kind of unusual. You're writing a novel that's a prequel to a show, and you're obviously writing it before the show has ever aired. So like, take us through how that happened, like, and just before we talk about like writing it, but how did you arrive at being able to do such an interesting, because I imagine the chance to write a prequel novel about a show that has it's a pretty rare thing. So how did you?
Well, I got the email. I kind of got the call. I think it was the guys at Simon & Schuster sort of emailed me and said, there's going to be a book with this show that you may have heard of. Would you like? Oh, yes, I would. Yes, please. Thank you. Oh, me immediately. Yes, please. You know, elbow all my friends out of the way. You know,
right.
Buses and things. So they wanted me to do it, and I was extremely keen. And then really it was a case of signing lots of legal agreements, say I wouldn't breathe a word, and you know, I wouldn't. There was a joke at the time is that once it was announced, people would be, what do you know about it? And all I would say is, I can confirm that I am writing a Star Trek Picard novel. Right. I'm doing that. So it's all very, you know, they really didn't want, there was a lot of interest in this show. They didn't want stuff leaking because that's right. Just no fun for anyone.
Sure.
Yeah. So, and then I guess the task was really to come up with a story because the show hadn't been aired. It was being written, scripts were still being written while I was writing the book. So I was getting scripts that were revised versions of scripts I'd already read. The task that we had, and that was me, Kirsten Byer, Dayton Ward, Margaret Clark, were kind of a little gang of us, a sort of novels writer's room, was to come up with a story that whilst it fed into the characters and situations, it wouldn't get impacted by events if events changed in the show. And that was okay because the book was set 15 years earlier. So we just sort of, we knew where the characters were going. We knew that journey was solid and pretty, you know, steady. Mm-hmm. So we just had to get the kind of steps in place so that it felt like they were plausibly these people, but 15 years earlier. Mm-hmm. I think people like Raffi in particular go on a very long journey from where she is at the start of my book to where she is by the end of the show. Where she is by the start of the show is a long enough journey. So we had to kind of juggle all this. And I think feeling confident that you could tell the stories, the character stories, and not worrying about how, you know, the end of the series was going to turn out, because that was 15 years in the future from my book anyway.
Right.
So the characters wouldn't know. So right. Not worrying about how that was going to happen, but really paying attention to these bits over here. So it was interesting. I don't think there was a great deal we had to change. There were maybe a few things here and there that we thought, oh, we need to tighten this, or the detail of that has changed. So can we sort of alter the tenor of some of these scenes? But very little actually that we had to sort of yank out and finesse and change. So interesting though.
I bet. So like, when did you know that, like, when did you get the actual thing to begin?
I forget now. It was probably maybe February or March, so probably just over a year ago.
Oh wow.
And then we worked really hard, because once you got the outline down tight, the actual novel writing is fairly straightforward. You just gotta sit down and, you know, put the words down. So we worked very, very hard to get a very, very solid outline. And obviously it's gonna be such a high profile show, it's gonna be a high profile book on the back of it.
Right.
We really wanted it to be solid. So it was a novel that was 100,000 words in length. And I think the outline that we ended up with was about 9,000 words. So we really kind of pinned it down to chapters and real clarity on what we wanted the story to do. And that's great. Once you've got a really good outline, then you just sit down and work really hard. And I was writing probably throughout last summer, so maybe June, July, August. And then submitted sort of third week of August, I think. Went away to France for a week. Remember holidays? We used to do those. And then I came back. There was some revisions, which was maybe a week's work at most, a couple of weeks. And then it was good to go, really. So it was all within a year.
Awesome. So you mentioned sort of a writer's room between the four of you. Was that something through the show or through Simon and Schuster, or how did those four? Well, obviously Kirsten Beyer is involved with the show and she's an author, but like Dayton Ward, and I didn't catch the fourth person.
Margaret Clark, who was previously an editor at Simon & Schuster and sort of works very closely still on their Trek Rage. Okay. And we worked with Ed Meisinger as well, who's the editor at Simon & Schuster. And then Dayton's in a sort of consultancy role, advising on the Trek Rage. And Kirsten, of course, was our point of contact.
Right.
She's the liaison between the comics and the novels and the production, so that we make sure that, you know, everything ties in and everything's going to work. And because she's been a Trek novelist herself, she kind of understands that you can really make these books pay off for viewers of the show and viewers who are also readers. You can really make these books and the TV show work together. So that was, I say writer's room, it's very informal. It's a lot of emails bouncing to and forth, but that's an easy way to sort of understand it. But that was the sort of, the four of us, and then Ed Schlesinger involved as well, obviously, at Simon & Schuster. We're bouncing ideas together and really sort of trying to come up with a story that we knew would suit the programme and feel like a really solid prequel. And it's great when you say it feels like a sort of earlier season, because that means tonally we got it exactly right.
Yes.
That's great to hear.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a question. How did you find the voices for these very well-known characters? You did a really good job.
Yes, you did.
Thank you very much. Well, Next Gen, I've been watching since I was, 16, started to arrive in the UK about 1988. When I was 16, to work out how old I am now. No, I feel like they're voices I've had with me for a long time. I loved Next Gen. I really watched it, and it's quite tricky to get. It was difficult to get in the UK. I was getting kind of video cassettes, two episodes once a month for quite a long time. And, you know, it's delays getting it on the BBC. You had to sign up to subscription channels. They were all starting at the time. So I really committed. And then I was reading the novels as well. So if those characters, I've watched that show again and again and again. I feel like I know Next Gen pretty well. And they are distinctive voices. They're voices that you sort of, they have a particular timbre to them. The newer characters, I obviously had the scripts, which were very solid, had a very strong idea of who people like Jurati and Raffi were. But I also went off and kind of watched things that they'd been in. I'd seen Alison Pill in things, so I had a sense of her physicality and how she might move or react. I mean, an actor's going to make different choices depending on the part.
Right.
Michelle Hurd, I kind of went off and watched some stuff with her in. But then some of the characters in the book are new. They're just in the book. So with those, I had a bit more freedom and just wrote characters that I thought suited this story or this situation. But Laris and Shaban, for example, I'd only read a tiny bit on the script and really hadn't had a chance to see much of what they were doing. They're not in the book very much. But then Geordie's in it. So, you know, I gave him a foiled kind of bounce off who I thought, you know, a slightly bolshy woman engineer who's, you know, got a heart of gold. It just seemed like a good pairing because, you know, you're carrying the story with conversations often.
Yeah.
You want those characters to be having a bit of fun, I think. So yeah, it's you sort of hope you're getting it right because people, it really matters to people that the characters are right. So you do really want it sort of to be successful. Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Well, I think you did a really good job. They really sounded true to themselves to me anyway, at least from everything I remember from watching The Next Generation and all the movies and all that. Yeah. So
I particularly like the scene with Picard and Crusher. I thought you nailed Beverly down quite good.
And I'm a big fan of Beverly Crusher. I think Gates McFadden is fantastic. I've seen her at conventions. And I think she's awesome. Just absolutely so talented, so generous. Her fan club with her, and she was just, you know, she knew them by name and made a real fuss of them. She was just A1. So I'm a big fan of Gates McFadden, and I love Crusher. I think she's a great character. So good. I think that scene's been a bit, I know people sort of are very invested in that relationship, and it's, you know, it kind of doesn't end happily. She had to be there. I think that was a late addition. We kind of read the book and went, there really should be a scene with Crusher. We can't just not do this. So that was something we did in revisions, actually, was at that scene.
Well, that was a good job.
As far as, like, I thought she did a great job with LaForge as well. And as far as Picard, I will say this, that when the book came out, it was right around, I think I read it the first time between episodes 4 and 5. I think it came out just before episode 4. And I was having a sort of a moment with Picard in episode 4. I was kind of like, this is not my captain. And then I read your book and all that went away.
Oh, good. Wow.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Because it really helped me kind of understand that. Because if Picard did not seem to me like Picard in your novel, I would have been like fighting with it the whole time. I never had that problem at all. Like from the very first, you know, words that were written.
That's really good. Thank you.
Yeah. And we both listened to the audiobook version. So kudos to the narrator.
Yes.
He's done quite a lot of my books. He's absolutely brilliant. Yeah. Because a very distinctive voice to try and emulate, I think.
Absolutely. And a narrator really can make or break an audiobook, honestly.
Yes. So. And all the different voices that he did as well. You know, he captured male and female, various different accents, aliens, all of that.
Yeah, it's heroic, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, these are often, you're reading for about 10 or 15 hours. It's a really, you know, it's really massive performance.
Right.
Really special skill, I think. Lots of stamina. And as you say, being able to kind of give variety to the different characters as you read. Yeah, he's terrific.
He really is.
And one of the characters that I thought you nailed down perfectly, I mean, everything he would say in the novel, I could hear Bruce Maddox. like literally saying, you know, my work.
What a cad, eh? He's such a bounder.
and I felt like your version of Bruce Maddox was much closer to the version of Bruce Maddox that we got in The Measure of a Man. I didn't particularly buy the one that was in Picard itself, but because he didn't look like him, he didn't really sound like him. But
we don't see much of him, do we? No,
I don't. No, I think we don't.
He's a very focused man, and you know, we've got this quite uncomfortable relationship with Jurati. I think, you know, a student of his and much younger, much and he's younger. Yeah, he's an absolute cad.
I was gonna say, like, when in 2381, like, how old is Jurati? Because she's already a doctor, but
yeah, I sort of had her in her. I think I had her in her sort of early 20s.
Yeah,
and I think I've read a couple of things online that you know, the actress's age, they kind of date it from that. But I don't think you can really do that. So you've got to. You know, actors play characters that are different ages all the time.
Yeah, that was my take too.
Kind of in her early 20s, and quite obviously brilliant, but I read her as quite gauche, not very perhaps experienced, even in friendships, certainly not in relationships. And this man is very, his attentions are very, very flattering. And he, of course, is flattered because she's his biggest fan. You know, so it's all about kind of, it's very codependent. It's a very unhealthy relationship to my mind. And I think I was working back from that because, of course, I knew how this relationship was going to end, which is not well.
Not usually well.
No, that's not typically how your first serious relationship ends. But there seemed to be some sort of, I mean, she has particular reasons for doing that. In the show, but I felt there needed to be something latent in that, and perhaps her own sort of unadmitted to herself fact that she was pretty badly used in this relationship.
Yeah, she was.
I kind of felt that way too. He sort of took advantage of her, I felt like, and not just because of his authority over her in the fact that he's a teacher, but he's so much older than her. And I mean, okay, people have relationships with younger people all the time, but I think it's a little bit different when you have a character or a person who is in sort of a, I mean, not to put it too grossly, but sort of a child relationship to this person. I mean, she's looking up to him as an older mentor type of relationship, and I feel like he kind of took advantage of that. I mean,
yeah, December work relationships work, and I know professor and grad student relationships that have turned out absolutely fine because everybody concerned, you feel it's consensual and mature. But in this case, I think you've got an inexperienced young woman, quite immature and vain older man.
Yeah.
Yeah,
petulant. Definitely. I think that was my favorite word used to describe him was petulant. I was like, oh yeah, he's definitely a petulant child.
Don't you know who I am? Sort of thing. I'm the mighty Bruce Maddox.
Right. So my work is more important than anyone else's work ever.
And he pulls it off in the end. He does do what he wanted to do. So you know, but to put a what cost, and certainly at a great cost to Agnes. Whom I adore. I love as a character. I really
like it.
Yeah, I love. She's so vulnerable, and I'd have done the same to him.
I mean, I feel the same way. I think we just had a show where I said that she was my favorite character of the new characters in Picard. Honestly, I like her a lot. I feel like she's very tragic too. And I think that she was kind of ill-used, and so she killed somebody. I mean,
who hasn't
had murdery thoughts every once in a while?
She's not. I think I'm very fond of Raffi, who I identified with I was writing the book over the summer holiday, so I sort of wasn't seeing very much of my little girl while she was on holiday, so I really felt that went into Raffi's story. I'm a big fan of Elnor is obviously adorable. Jurati and Raffi in particular were a great success for me.
I think you did very well with both of them, honestly. I didn't listen until to your book until after, I can't remember when I first read. Do you remember when I read it, Brian?
It was probably around episode 6 or 7. I know it was 2 or 3 weeks later.
Yeah. I didn't. Well, I was in the middle of another book series. It wasn't anything.
Yeah, it's hard to kind of pull away. Yeah.
Yeah. Brian was like, "You gotta read this." You gotta read this. Like, okay, it's on my list. And I was, you know, and fully intending to. Was not regretful at all about it. But when we're first watching the show, the JL thing from Rafi kind of was like, I don't. That feels like that's out of nowhere, and it doesn't really, I mean, but then I'm grateful to the novel because it sort of eased that.
Right. Yeah.
A little bit. That sort of like, I don't know how to explain it. Like, it wasn't really an irritation, but it was kind of like, oh, that's just not right. I don't know what it is, but it just doesn't seem right. But then listening to the book,
obviously very different from anything that anyone would have said to him on the Enterprise.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
But then Rafi is very different from anyone he would have worked with on the Enterprise. You know, he's got very comfortable with this staff, this crew that he knows. And then he's, you know, he's brought none of them with him on this ship. He's sent Geordi to, you know, another mission to spearhead a really important part of the operation. So he's got new people and they've got their own style. And she comes out, he's brought her to you know, be the person who tells him when he's, you know, making a mistake, he's doing stupid things, and isn't paying attention. So she's there to be someone who's not an irritant, but is not a yes woman. Right. And JL is very her.
Yeah, she kind of fills the roles of several of the next gen characters in a way.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
I mean, and she's part like counselor, part doctor, part Data, part Riker. It's in a lot of ways, a lot of the things that he got from, you know, several characters he's getting from her. And, you know, and I think you do a really good job of drawing that.
Find the nickname refreshing, actually. He's probably, things are all different.
Yeah.
So I'm glad that relationship works. Thank you.
Yeah.
Good.
Now, obviously, the comic book was being worked on at the same time. Like, was there a conscious decision to, like, I know you mentioned Laris and Shaban. You didn't really work with them, but they're focused more in the comic book. So was there, like, something, did you have to work with the, and also that Yu-Yat Beta story wasn't told in the novel. So did you have to work together with the comic book as well to kind of figure out what stories to
find it? Originally we were going to have Laris and Shaban in, and then we decided that that was the story for the comics, that they needed this focus here, because I have a sense they may have been a bit of a breakaway success, that, you know, they were
yes, definitely.
The story kind of grew. Sometimes you find this with characters, that you invent them and they're placeholders because you just need someone to go, but what do you mean, JL, you know, in an episode? And then actually they turn out to be really interesting. So my sense is that these were people who became, and then that means they deserve their own story, and the comic was ideal for that. And we kind of had a place for them in the book, which towards the end with the stuff with the Romulan senator, we thought of putting that story there. And instead, what that story becomes is a kind of precursor. It should sort of feel like a precursor that he wasn't able to save. So the senator has a kind of sidekick bodyguard that they're not able to save. And I'd like you to sort of think that that's preying on Picard's conscience when he meets Laris and Shaban, and their sort of story unfolds. So hopefully, it all kind of ends up as a much deeper and richer story as a result. And I had more fun because rather than focusing on Laris and Shaban, I got to focus on the senator, who's a great villain. So villains are always great fun to write. You try not to write villains because they're a bit obvious, but some people are just villainous, you know.
Yeah.
And he's the full twirly mustache kind of. he's the kind of, yeah, I'm sure we can just drink bleach and it will be. majority of in denial, I think. So he's that kind of villain.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
How did you get into the mindset of writing from the point of view of people in the Romulan Star Empire? I mean, obviously you're not in that type of a government situation. So it's for me anyway, when I think about something like that, it's really hard for me to conceptualize because I have no real frame of reference other than, you know, other movies I've seen, stuff I've read, things I've heard, you know, that kind of stuff. So how did you get into that type of mindset? Because to me personally, it really reminded me of what I've heard, I've never been there, about North Korea. So
very good. Right. Okay. Yeah. So you sort of picked that up. Yeah, absolutely. And this was sort of hammered home in the scripts that the key to understanding their culture is the secrecy. Yeah. And so I thought, okay, all right then. And I've read a lot about North Korea. I was interested in it a few years back and read a lot around it and read a lot sort of accounts of people that escaped and come to South Korea and talked about what it was like. And I'd one of my previous books, I'd kind of written about the Zenkethi, and I'd kind of conceptualized their society as a bit like North Korean society, only it has Zenkethi society I had as kind of abundant, so there wasn't kind of famine or poverty that you get in North Korea. But yeah, that kind of secrecy that people can't even taught the truth to themselves, I think, was preying on my mind. And I'm old enough to remember, I read 1984, and so I've read about Doublethink, and I'm old enough to remember pre-collapse of communist Russia and Eastern European states. So growing up, you're kind of conscious of knowing that there are states where it's not safe to speak your mind, that you might even worry about thinking your mind. And that really was what I was trying to ingrain into particularly a character like Brittette, who certainly by the end, when he's sort of, I'm going to assume people listening to this have read the book, spoilers.
Go ahead.
By the Tal Shiar, there's a little bit the echo of the, you know, the four lights with the Cardassians and Picard, but also very much that kind of fear that you might lose your mind because of totalitarian pressure, which you would kind of get from 50s, 60s, 70s accounts of the Soviet Union or, under the Stasi or in Romania under their secret service. And I think these are sort of things I'd thought about from when I was, quite small. But North Korea, yeah, you're bang on there. I was particularly thinking about that, particularly as the kind of denying that there's any sort of where's all the food going sort of thing? Oh, well, it can't be a problem can't be a problem with up top, you know?
Right.
And the sense that, you know, all the rich ones have been gone. They're like, oh, this looks a bit, we better get out of town, you know?
Yeah, it's a bit dodgy. Let's be.
Yeah.
It reminded me a little bit of the movie Soylent Green.
Soylent
Green. Yes.
A long time since I've seen that.
Yeah. Yeah. The takeaway that I got coming out of this with the Romulans is that Romulan government was pretty messed up.
Yeah.
Like, what do you think was actually going on, like, in the decision makers of the Romulan government? Like, were they as, like, really caught off guard as it seemed, or were they doing things that we didn't see in the novel?
Or were they really just in denial?
I think maybe, I think I kind of designed this sort of uncertainty in, because at the back of my mind I always had that what's driving them is this secrecy, this sense of secrecy.
Yeah.
And that will need secrecy in all branches of government. And if that's your kind of driving motivation, it doesn't really matter if anyone's got a full picture or not.
Yeah.
Because nobody's operating as if they are. And that's only ever going to be dysfunctional because people are going to be making bad decisions because they won't have full information, or they won't trust that other people might be giving them full information, but they won't believe them because they know they're thinking I'm probably keeping a secret. And also there's clearly, and this is a problem for many governments at the moment, I think, there's clearly a problem that people don't tell their superiors things that they think their superiors don't want to hear.
Right.
For fear of getting dragged off and having your fingers broken.
Or worse.
one thing, yeah, or just having somebody shout at you, which is quite scary, I think. Or, you know, you might, yeah, you might think you won't get, you might lose your place in the wrong situation, you might lose your place on the lifeboat, you know, that's right. The last you'll be, you won't be on that shuttle out, neither will your, you know, six tiny children, sort of thing. So
yeah,
if you're operating in a society that's secretive, that operates on fear and doubt and threat, it's never going to function very well. Whereas a society that my sort of suggestion was that an open society, one that you know, has full information, that educates people to be literate in understanding that information, is going to function. And doubt comes in when people are either not trusting the authorities and the institutions, or don't have a sense of their own limitations. I think it's a problem we have at the moment across the world, is that people kind of go, well, what do we need experts for? Because they're actually quite well informed. Just thought, yeah. And you know, it's you know, we've all got an opinion, but we might not have full facts. Or we might not have a full ability to understand what those facts mean.
Right.
And partly, I could just imagine people being wrong. What do these astronomers know anyway? I know that it's supernovas are because of star goats. You know, yeah. Oh, star goats. Yeah, what they need is a really good dose of bleach. Yeah, it's the bleach. So I think this is the. I think this was all. Obviously, I'm writing well before our current situation, but. You can certainly see this. You can see this over anti-vaccination campaigns well prior to coronavirus. Yeah. You know, people are kind of like, oh, well, you know, I don't trust it. I know, but it does work. Is the thing?
Yeah, yeah,
it works really well. But it needs us all to kind of sign up to it. So these are the kind of things I think about. This kind of corrosion of trust for whatever reasons. In these big institutions and projects that we have, so that's sort of where it came out from. And obviously, it's not functioning very well. I don't know if anyone in the Romulan government has full information. There might be a handful of people, but to all intents and purposes, they may as well not, because right. Their superiors, their juniors, will be going, oh, we cannot tell them this. Right. This is such an almighty
company. Yeah.
They will shout at me so much. I will. Oh, my six children not on the lifeboat. So, so to all intents and purposes, you know, it's just not functioning.
Yeah,
for sure.
Lots of people die as a result. And whether that's fixable, I don't know. I don't know.
So, what did you envision in terms of like how many Romulans died in this?
Oh gosh, I didn't. I sort of couldn't. A lot.
A lot.
A lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not a good outcome, I think, for many yeah. people.
For sure. So then, how did you, or was there any particular politician you sort of had in mind or were thinking of when you were writing Quest?
The senator, particularly the senator at the end, I had lots of politicians. I've got I've got a very long list of targets. It's more of a style of politics that I had in mind. This kind
okay.
of because we don't really, apart from that senator at the end, who's not really in the great scheme of things, that senator isn't really very powerful, but he's indicative of a kind of, you know, he's not the boss, and right. he's not really high up in government, but he's sufficiently powerful to be able to have an impact on a large number of people. Right. And that can be as low down as a city mayor. It can be the head of a school.
Yeah.
It can be the vice chancellor of a university or a head of a university. It's sort of scalable, really, but it's a style of politics. And a style of politics that's based on kind of bombast, self-importance, authoritarianism, a closed mind, and a refusal to admit when you're wrong, and to listen to people who are well informed.
Yeah. And the Federation politicians? Quest.
Yeah, Quest. She was very interesting, and I liked how you chose a politician from a small world, because I've often wondered this myself, like, you know, these small federation worlds versus the founding worlds. And, you know, there are also several other worlds that are seem to be pretty prominent in the federation as well that weren't part of the founding ones, like Trill and Beta Zed. And
No doubt in my mind. I mean, again, it's not particular people I had in mind, but I particularly had a dynamic, which is obviously in the UK, we had just come out of the Brexit vote and the kind of fallout from that. I've actually got quite a lot of sympathy for some of the smaller nations, places like Greece that would say, well, actually we've taken quite a battering from EU banking policy over the last decade. You know, it's been austerity politics has been very, very tough. And aren't we all meant to be equal partners? You know, we're a small country on the periphery. But why is it that we seem to be taking more of a bashing than, say, Germany or France? So I've got a lot of sympathy with that. I don't think the answer is then for the kind of one of the biggest economies in Europe to kind of throw its toys out of the pram and go off having a massive tantrum. I was like, a really bad solution to re-energizing institutions. I had a kind of, you know, I know that people had good reasons for voting to leave the EU, and, you know, quite credible reasons, some of them, some of them not, you know, fears about not being listened to or losing power or seeing no benefits from membership of this club. Brexit tended to be voted by people who are quite marginalised or don't have much influence on politics in the UK. So Quest kind of came from that. She kind of came from a sort of, you know, maybe a Greek politician saying, why exactly are we in this? Because we don't seem to be getting anything from it. Whereas these guys over there, and not even in it at all, are getting all the intention. You know, you're sending all this stuff over there, and we're meant to be members of the club, but we're working with, you know, rubbish replicators or infrequent transport ships and this kind of thing. So Quest has got a good point. I also think she's quite... she's quite a cold fish and quite ambitious. So I think she latches onto a message that certainly advances her career.
In every home. Didn't quite work out that way, though.
I ever said that. And she was sort of that trick that politicians have that makes you forget they ever said something.
Yeah.
But she does very well at the end of the book. I think she's on her way to high things.
We have some listener questions that we want to get to, but there were two characters that I wanted to just touch base on, and that was a new character, which is Coley, and an existing character that we don't get to see much in Picard, but certainly plays a big role, and that's Clancy. So I particularly liked you drawing that character of Clancy, bringing her out in the novel. But first on Coley, like, how did you come up with that character? And the big question I have is, why did Coley make that sudden change where she seemed to be on board and then she gets to Nimbus 3 and everything, you know, she just can't take it?
Yeah. I think it's Coley. I was thinking of as a. I thought, where else in this world, in this kind of milieu, has there been a kind of massive refugee crisis? There would be experts on this. There would be people who would know about dealing with refugees and the best things to do, and the ways to make the process as smooth as possible. And these people would be from Bajor. They would have experienced occupation. They would have been refugees. They would have come into the Federation. And specialised in this. So you'd see this in things like the United Nations now or International Red Cross and Crescent. So I was thinking, where are these people from? And a Bajoran would be a really good person to have on board because it would be a voice from the disenfranchised. And I think it's very easy when you're dealing in humanitarian crises to not have the voice of the people who are being affected. It's very easy to just deal with, you know, the experts. The experts or the administrators or the people who are running the institution. Oh, we need to do this and forget the actual individual experience. So I wanted a kind of voice for that, a conduit for that, and a Bajoran seemed a good idea. But ultimately, I think that Picard is kind of finding himself pulled in all these directions, and he does have institutional requirements that he needs to fulfill. And perhaps that doesn't go far enough for Coley. And I think as well, it's constantly getting this message back from the center, no, we can't do this, there are political reasons, would be distressing for her. She would remember her childhood on Bajor and would want to be giving more. And I think eventually what she runs up against is the limits of what the Federation mission can do. And it's not good enough for her. This is a situation where they fail badly. And it's too much like the occupation of Bajor. And that's why she leaves. It's not good enough for her. So that's where Coley was coming from. Clancy, I kind of envisaged as a sort of, on the video you can see me the tissue. I do not have coronavirus.
We won't be releasing the video, so don't worry about that.
That's okay.
I will take a screenshot. Yeah, I will take a screenshot before we go.
Don't worry, I'm not sick.
That's okay. That's fine. Social distancing.
Yeah, we're socially distant across a continent, so we're good.
That should be just about enough. So Clancy, I kind of envisaged, I guess the kind of joke in my mind was, well, if Picard is sort of the baby boomer, then Clancy's kind of Generation X we heard all about how brilliant it was at Woodstock, but now I've got this kind of organization to run, and you're swanning around like it's the 1980s, and it's not. It's 2016. Things are falling apart. So that was sort of the generational tension that I was sort of, you know, joking about in the back of my mind. So Clancy's a different generation. She's maybe come up through the Dominion War. She's had very different experiences. She's not had this experience of abundance and freedom to do whatever you choose that perhaps someone like Picard has had. Picard is not seeing that the situation is changing, and that, you know, there are internal pressures in the Federation that he's not recognizing. So that's kind of where Clancy was coming from. That's how I kind of played it.
Awesome.
Cool.
Have a couple, I think three listener questions that we're going to ask real quick. The first is from James, the augmented sailor, who says, I was thinking about, did she have any thoughts on the explanation for the clearly self-induced Romulan supernova?
Yeah, I kept waiting for them to discuss this in Picard, and they never did.
Yeah.
But you hinted at it in the novel several times that the supernova seemed to be acting in a way that was not natural. So
yeah, I think I can't remember now. I can't remember now whether I had an explanation for that or not.
No, you didn't. But no, you just,
I can't remember if I had one, if we had one in our heads or not.
Right.
Yeah, I'm stuck on that one. Can't answer that one. I don't know.
I guess the question would be,
didn't tell me they were, it was this.
do you have any idea who did it? Was the Jat Vash involved, or was Section 31 involved or something like that? Or do you think it was just some other, do you have any idea who it might be?
Yeah.
And I realize we can't hold you to it, but just headcanon, what did you think it might have been? Yeah.
Well, my headcanon is, I think for a writer, when you're trying to induce uncertainty, it's sometimes, usually what I would say to people writing is always know. If you never know, if you never tell the reader, that's fine, but you must know exactly. I think this is one of these cases where, in fact, it suited me to be uncertain, because it meant that kind of, it's what I was talking about before, even the kind of highest authority, who's a higher authority than the author, if they're kind of uncertain in their minds, then I think it plays through a kind of paranoia in the book. So that's my kind of cop-out answer.
Mm-hmm. I hope that's something that is eventually talked about, because it kind of seemed like, to me anyway, I can't imagine someone would purposefully want to destroy their entire civilization, even a Romulan. I think maybe someone was screwing around and oops.
Now, wouldn't you? And still bleach.
Okay. Fair enough. All right. The next one, Brian from Hawaii says, the book was excellent, and I have so many questions. The biggest question, unanswered by the book for me, was why is Utopia Planitia the only shipyards available to Starfleet? Of all the resources in the Federation, are we to believe it's the only one that can build the ships needed for the Romulan evacuation mission?
That's a good question. Thank you very much, Brian. I'm glad you liked the book, and I hope it is lovely in Hawaii. You say Hawaii, and I think, oh, how lovely. Okay. So I think it's the one they commit to. It's where they're set up and where this operation is happening. And perhaps they've got, I think, a large, you know, so much of the book is about how much resource do we commit to this, that when it all goes haywire, as indeed it does, then there's probably not anything else advanced enough to be able to tool up sufficiently quickly. And also the will is steadily dripping away. It's what they're able to commit to, get the political will behind at the start. But then, you know, we're several years on and committing to turning something else over to it was never going to fly within the politics of the book. So that would be my kind of answer to that, I think, which I hope helps.
Okay. I think so.
Kim from San Diego, who is one of the co-hosts of another podcast on Talk Through Media, Rebinged DS9. She asks, is Bruce Maddox the villain of the story?
Is Bruce the villain of the story? He's the villain of that romance. who is the villain of the story? I think secrecy and mistrust and bad faith are the villains of the story.
Interesting.
And possibly the Romulan senator, but that's bad faith, I think.
Yeah.
So certain types of behavior, I think, are and Bruce's sort of sins are hubris and vanity, and as it says in a kid's book that I love, nemesis is what clobbers you when hubris is what you've got. I think he pretty much nemesis comes a clobbering for Bruce. He's not, and yet at the same time he does have this incredible vision, you know, a vision that he follows wholeheartedly, and that's mirrored in Picard. Picard has a vision for what this relief mission could be, and he pursues it wholeheartedly, mm-hmm. and he ends up out on his ear. So those stories are sort of intentionally meant to kind of refract and mirror off each other in a way. And others have their own vision of great projects or what the Federation could be or, you know, what life and the world should be like. But I think Bruce's sins are a vanity and he's a bit puffed up with his own opinion.
Do you think Picard also suffered from vanity a little bit?
I think it's not vanity, but I think it is a kind of, there's a sort of tunnel vision.
Mm-hmm.
I remember sort of, I said to Kirsten, it'd be really helpful if you sort of, if you give me kind of three things that you think are really key about Picard. I think what's interesting about Picard is that he's probably the best human. Yeah. He's sort of, he's like the ideal.
Great man, as you called
him. Yeah, but he's. Yeah. But he's humble, he's moderate, he's temperate, he's wise, he's considered, he's very well read, he listens to experts. But she said, then he is human, you know, so he will have a flaw. And Kirsten's sense of what his flaw is that he's the wisest man that you could come across, unless he misses something, and then he really misses it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think he's distant from Earth in this book. He's a little bit older and has different experiences from the decision makers, and he misses the way that the mood is changing, and it ends with him kind of backed into a corner, I think, and the only thing he can do is kind of resign, and then there's lots of other things that arise from that, so the shock of failure I think is quite difficult for him to cope with. So that's how I was kind of reading Picard, this sort of intense wisdom, except when it's not, and then it's, you know, it's bad news.
Yeah, for sure.
I wanted to just touch base on a couple of other things you've had, one you're working on and one you've already worked on. I also read the Tilly novel that you did, The Way of the Stars. And that is a much different novel than this Picard one. Like, this one is very world building and tells the story from a number of perspectives, whereas this one is largely Tilly. You know, we get a little bit of her, you know, grandmother and, you know, step grandfather in there. And of course, a little bit of Siobhan, but it's, you know, her mother, but it's mostly Tilly. So tell us a little bit about like the writing of that and how you decided to give her this adventure.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's much easier because obviously Discovery had been on for a season, so I'd actually seen Tilly in action. I'd seen the character, the actor as well, who I love. I think it's a brilliant character, really wonderful.
And again, I think you really nailed her voice too.
Oh, thank you. Easier again, I think, with the sort of, because I'd heard her kind of deliver the lines and things. You can get the intonation. But it's a classic coming of age novel. It's a Bildungsroman. It's about somebody discovering themselves and going out into the world and learning what their way is, their way to the stars, what their path should be and their journey should be and their career and their vocation. So classic sort of, you know, you can read countless stories like this about young men, you know, from the kind of romantic period onwards, you know, and lo, I did leave home and went on a great journey, sort of thing. So that was the idea of the book, and that keeps it very tightly focused on Tilly. You're wanting to be with her, and you'll meet characters who have an effect on that. So the kind of other people that she meets are sort of mentors or guides or spur her on in some way. And with the Picard book, I think you're at the other end of somebody's career. He's at the height of his powers. And we're seeing someone at the height of his powers go in the other direction rather than the move towards success, has to sort of confront failure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, at the end of the book, Picard has failed. I mean, we then are able to pick up the show and kind of see the other half of that story, obviously the main part of that story, which is coming back from failure. So and also I was telling a story about a universe in flux. So and a universe in which people were uncertain about other people. So it needed multiple voices because not everybody had the full picture. Tilly has the full picture of her life in Way to the Stars, but nobody has the full picture of what's going on in The Last Best Hope, which is partly why things fall apart, I think. So that's sort of the choices that sort of guided how many raters there would be in both books, I think.
Awesome. Now, I guess it's time to wrap up. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Tell us about what you're working on now.
So the big project is probably one that people would, listeners probably enjoy, which is that I have been involved in a book called The Autobiography of Catherine Janeway, which is coming out from Titan later this year. And that's they've done a couple of books like this. It's a sort of first-person point of view. So they've done an autobiography of Kirk, an autobiography of Picard. But this is Catherine Janeway's. It's sort of tying into the anniversary of the show. And it's the conceit is that it's her and, you know, I'm the kind of editor. It's like Janeway and I have sat down over coffee and I've interviewed, you know, and a number of mornings and afternoons, and then we've kind of written up this story. But it's from her, and I was born in the Midwest in da 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 da, right up to sort of goes through, you know, childhood. The
and I found that I loved coffee.
that's an important step to cover. Who gets her coffee? You know, who gets her hooked on this stuff? The pusher. So. Obviously it turns out to be, well, I won't say. And then it kind of follows her through career, Voyager, and then a little bit onwards into her sort of, so it takes you up to maybe about 10 or 15 years after that. And it's her looking back on all of this. Cool. Yeah, so that's
awesome.
I finished Picard, had a little holiday, and then I kind of watched Voyager in about a month.
Right? I really enjoyed it. Yeah.
And then wrote the book, which is just a hoot to do. It was huge fun. First person's always really good fun. So that's out later in the year, in the meantime, just you know, I'm always doing stuff for Big Finish, who are the sort of Doctor Who and spin-off series folks who do those audio dramas. And if anybody is a reader of a brilliant science fiction writer called Lois McMaster-Bujold, who writes space opera and some military SF and fantasy, I've just finished up a collection of essays that I've co-edited, and that's going to be out later in the year. So just got the last proofs of that in. So that's non-fiction essays, but she's a great writer, and people might enjoy them if they've read her. So yeah, so that's what I'm doing.
Awesome. Great. Well, tell us how people can follow you or keep up with you.
Definitely Twitter, at Una McCormack, where I'm usually just shouting a bit about things. I've got a website, unamccormack.co.uk. I'm thinking I might set up a sort of like a tiny letter or a MailChimp sort of thing, a newsletter thing. So I'm sort of playing with that at the moment, seeing how that works. So if people follow me on Twitter, I'll sort of put the subscription up for that. So if there's not enough of me in their lives, there can be more me.
Absolutely.
Maybe people are on a bit of overload at the moment, but yeah, that's the main sort of places. Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down with us. It was a treat. And I look forward to the Janeway novel. I think that's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. I hope so. I had a great time writing it. So I hopefully that will kind of carry through. People will just, I hope it's just a really good fun read, you know, amusing, entertaining, kind of, you know, thought provoking. So yeah,
a bit of fun. Sure it will. Thank you so much.
Thanks ever so much for having me on, guys. Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. So we want to thank Una for joining us today for that. And this was recorded as part of our Patreon. But everyone else is getting this because of coronavirus. So, but... for everyone else, why don't you tell people how to contact us?
All right. If you want to submit your feedback or connect with us, you can do that by going to talkthroughmedia.com/feedback, where you can submit text or audio. You can leave us a voicemail by calling 216-232-6146. You can send us an email, and the email is picardcast@talkthroughmedia.com. Or you can post in our designated episode thread in our Facebook group, which is facebook.com/groups/StarTrekTTMpodcasts. So look out for that thread. We don't know when it will be because we don't have any planned episodes necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, the next thing that we are going to have is our roundtable. So
right, but no planned episodes of Star Trek Picard, obviously.
Right, it's going to be a while for that. And Discovery, same thing for that, for those of you that are on our Discovery feed. Yeah. Our Twitter for Picard is PicardCast, and we also have Star Trek TTM, which sort of covers both, but it's mostly for Discovery these days. But one to highlight that I've started doing Instagram. So I've created a new Instagram account for us, and that's at Star Trek TTM. And I'm also using Instagram a lot for my personal stuff, and you'll also see a lot of stuff for the podcasts on there. So add me if you haven't already at Brian Melosh. And up until recently, I didn't use it at all, but I've started using it a lot lately. So a great way you can support us, though, is to share our content when it comes up on Twitter and Facebook, and of course, now Instagram. The Talk Through Media page is at facebook.com/talkthroughmedia, and those are posts that you'll be able to share widely, whereas the Facebook group is a private group, so those you can't share, but the bigger posts will post on the Facebook page, so you'll get them there. I also wanted to mention, it's not in our notes here, but we have launched two new podcasts to the network. You may have heard them on our feed. The first is the Rebinged Deep Space Nine podcast that Kim and James are doing. Not James the Augmented Sailor, but James Kim's husband, James. But anyway, that's out in the, it's now on its own feed. So that you got the first episode, but subsequent episodes have been released. And Ruthie was on the new Let's Talk Through podcast, where you guys discussed
Galaxy Quest
and the Never Surrender
a Galaxy Quest
documentary. And that was also released on this feed, and that also has its own feed. You can get both those podcasts as well as our podcasts through the Talk Through Media all-inclusive feed, but we released the first episodes of those to our feed, just so you know, especially with Ruthie being on it, I thought it would be good if you needed your Ruthie fix, you could have heard her on there. But Kyle and Mark are handling the Let's Talk Through. Those are my two co-hosts for the Walking Dead Talk Through, and they're now doing that podcast. So hopefully, I'm not involved with either one. So I may come on and guest, but I'm Picard and Discovery keep me busy enough. So
yes,
yeah,
that was lots of fun though.
Subscribe to us in Apple Podcasts or the podcast client of choice. And while you're there, give us a rating or review. And of course, our Patreon, which you may be listening to us on there. That's at patreon.com/Brian and Ruthie. You will have gotten this episode earlier than everyone else, as well as we released our last Patreon call to the regular feed. You will have heard it by the time that this comes out, but that's our episode 15 has not been released to the feed yet. But actually, we made that episode public, our call-in show from last week. So if you go to patreon.com/Brian and Ruthie, you can actually listen to it before it hits the main feed. And that one is an uncensored version. There are some things that I have to pull out of the final censored version that we'll post on the feed. But anyway, we want to thank our Patreon supporters, James Robbins, Lawrence Todd, Fred Petrie, Clint McCollum, Kyle McAdams, Kim Vogel, Brian Shiro, Christoph Lechleitner, Jeff Biacco, Lee Radke, Aaron Mays, Michael Carrier, Stephen Chambers, Kevin Lyle, and our newest patron, Jeff Gentry. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
And our next episode, from the Patreon side, we will actually be doing a Patreon about The Last Best Hope. So that's the next thing that you'll hear. We may release that to the regular feed. We may not, just depends on how that one goes. After that, our next one will be the roundtable to discuss season one of Picard. So you'll get sometime in May. So, but until next time, I'm Brian.
And I'm Ruthie.
Peace and long life.
Live long and prosper.